like that of the self-realized soul. Translation. If one hears and chants or remembers this narration in the morning and evening with great attention, he certainly becomes learned, experienced in understanding the Vedic hymns, and expert in self-realization. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnana Jnana Salakaya Chaksarun Mutamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpatirubhyascha Kripasindubhyevacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So after several verses here, we have a final verse which gives us a benediction or sort of a summary of this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Is Nagaraj here? Is there, I think you mentioned once, isn't there a particular word for this kind of verse? Is there a term for it? What is it? Palashruti. So in other words, after we've been heard a certain narration or pastimes in the Bhagavatam, then there's this concluding verse that tells us what benefit we get from hearing this. So I thought this was rather interesting because in some ways it seems like a sort of an ordinary story of more lineages that we've been hearing of the different descendants of the Manus and these different dynasties, although it's not exactly an ordinary type of story. We have Lord Shiva appearing and great sages like Angira Muni, and so from our perspective it's actually quite extraordinary. But yet you might wonder, what is it about this story and hearing this pastime and narration that would give us this benediction? There are almost no purports here, and usually Srila Prabhupada did not write purports when the previous acharyas did not write purports on a particular section of Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's left for our own understanding to try to determine the lessons and what we can gain from this particular part of the Bhagavatam. So the story of Nabhaga is rather interesting. Of course, he is the father of Maharaj Ambarish, so he's a great personality in his own right. And of course, he was a great king, great devotee. But if we look at the story, we can, I think, see a few important qualities that Nabhaga represented. First of all, he was very submissive to authority. We can see that he completely followed the instruction of his father. He totally submitted to Lord Shiva, to his instruction, to Angira Muni and the other sages. So he represented this quality that one accepted spiritual authority. In other words, these were qualified personalities, great sages. His father was a great personality. Obviously, he didn't recognize Lord Shiva at first, but once he understood that this was actually Lord Shiva who had come to ask for the share of sacrifices, apparently the sacrifice was to Lord Shiva, or at least he was one of the recipients of the sacrifice, he immediately gave up his idea that this is mine and simply offered it to Lord Shiva. So he had this this quality. Also, we can see that he was not attached to material possessions. He was basically given this complete flim-flam cheat from his brothers about, you know, we took all your money, but that's all right. We gave you your father as your share. What does that mean? Of course, his father merely said, "This is ridiculous. I'm not your property." You know, so but he didn't take that so badly, and his father tried to help him out. Here's something that you can do. Somehow his father, obviously being a great devotee himself, knew that the sages were going to make some mistake in the mantras that they were chanting for this great sacrifice. So he told them these verses. Nabhaga apparently told them the verses which made the sacrifice complete. At least that's how I'm thinking, interpreting the story a little bit. And therefore, out of gratitude for him, when they went off to the heavenly planets, they left him all the money and the dakshin or the different shares of the sacrifice that were there. Then, so he accepts that. Then Lord Shiva comes and says, "No, this is mine." And when his father confirms, "Yes, this is Lord Shiva, and he does deserve everything here," he immediately accepted that as well. So we can see that he was not attached really to anything. You know, he was willing certainly to take whatever was rightfully his, but if it was not his, he easily gave it up. So he had this quality of not being attached to material possessions. And in the one purport that we do have here, Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport to text 3 that Nabhaga was very simple-hearted, and therefore his father tried to help him to see how he could gain some kind of wealth. And of course, these were all Kshatriya kings, and they do need some kind of wealth. That's what they do. That's their dharma. So this quality of simplicity, I mean, simple-hearted, is very, very important, and I think that's one thing that we can learn from this story and that we can gain from this narration. The quality of being simple or simplicity is extremely important as part of Vaishnava qualities. We see the qualities listed actually by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Majjha Lila describes the 26 qualities of the devotee. And number 9 in that list is the term akenchana. Now akenchana usually is translated as without possessions, having no material possessions, and which is what we were talking about with Napagi, that he was not attached to material possessions. Interesting, though, in different translations of the 26 qualities, sometimes, at one point at least, that Prabhupada translated akenchana as being simple. That this is a quality devotee, that they are simple, that they are simple-hearted. Now, this word simple in English sometimes has a negative connotation. Sometimes we think of simple as being naive, or perhaps maybe even not mentally very quick, very astute. That's one meaning of the word simple. But simple also means not complicated, right? It means one who accepts things very easily, that does not overcomplicate issues. And so if one is simple-hearted, that's actually a very wonderful quality in a devotee. The gopis in Vrindavan were called simple-hearted. The coward men, when Prabhupada says, they were all simple-hearted. So this simple-hearted quality is actually a great adornment for a devotee. This is a very good quality because it means that they have very simple faith. They have very simple and very pure faith without looking for so many things for themselves. There's one other translation that I found that Prabhupada gives this word akenchana. He also describes one that says without motive. So these things you can see all are very similar. They go together. Without possession, without motive, that one is very simple. So these are some very, very important qualities that we can learn from the story of Nabhaga. So devotees are known by their spiritual qualities and character, and this is what's actually attractive to Krishna. And this is from Srimad Bhagavatam 4:20:16. Verse says, "My dear king, I am very captivated by your elevated qualities and excellent behavior, and thus I am very favorably inclined toward you. You may therefore ask from me any benediction you like. One who does not possess elevated qualities and behavior cannot possibly achieve my favor simply by performance of sacrifice, austerity, or mystic yoga. But I always remain equipoised in the heart of one who is always also equipoised in all circumstances." Who in the purport Srila Prabhupada said, "Lord Vishnu was very pleased with Maharaj Prithu's good character and behavior and offered him a benediction. The Lord openly says that performing great sacrifice or undergoing austerity of mystic yoga practice cannot satisfy him. He is pleased only by the elevated character and behavior. But these cannot develop unless one becomes a pure devotee of the Lord. Anyone who has developed unalloyed, unflinching devotional service unto the Lord develops his original good qualities as spirit soul. The spirit soul is part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is all the good qualities of the Lord. When the spirit soul is contaminated by material modes of nature, one is considered good or bad with reference to material qualities. But when one is transcendental to all material qualities, all the good qualities come out. These qualities of the devotee, 26 in number, are listed as follows." So this is interesting. These are not mundane qualities. The 26 qualities are, Prabhupada is saying, these are qualities of the soul. These are our natural, inherent qualities and characteristics that we have. But they're usually covered over by material nature and covered over by these bodies and minds. But when we become advanced in Krishna consciousness, and we become more and more situated in our original eternal position as pure spirit soul, servant of Krishna, then these qualities naturally develop, and they naturally come out. I'll go ahead. We'll read these. The 26 qualities are: kind to everyone, does not quarrel with anyone, fixed in the absolute truth, equal to everyone, faultless, charitable, mild, clean, simple. This is the kinchin of the simple as it's translated in this particular purport. Benevolent, peaceful, completely attached to Krishna, has no material hankering, meek, steady, self-controlled, does not eat more than required, sane, respectful, humble, grave, compassionate, friendly, poetic, expert, and silent. The Lord is satisfied by development of the transcendental qualities of the living entity and not by artificial performance of sacrifice and mystic yoga. So as we advance in devotional service, these qualities become more and more manifest. Now, in one hand, it's described that these qualities develop naturally, and one does not have to separately endeavor to try to become meek or try to become simple or try to become, you know, humble or these things. At the same time, Srila Prabhupada also said that we can judge the level of advancement of a devotee by how much these qualities are manifest. So while we're not necessarily striving to, now I have to work today on this one, I have to work on number 14 today, at the same time, we can understand that if I'm not developing these qualities in myself, if I'm not seeing them manifest, at least to some degree, or not seeing some improvement, then perhaps I need to look at my practice of devotional service. In other words, what am I doing? Why am I not doing so well that these qualities are not manifesting? Of course, it may take some time. You know, we come into this material world with so many bad habits and so many anarthas from the past that it may not be an immediate thing. And we don't so much judge the devotees. We don't go around and saying, well, I don't see that you're developing this one or that one, because we understand that devotees are in the process of purification. And it'll take some time for the contamination of the material world to fall away and for the heart to become completely pure and cleansed. No, but still, we see that these qualities will manifest as one advances in Krishna consciousness. And it's also important to understand that good qualities, the real, true spiritual qualities, only manifest through devotional service and are seen in devotees. They're not seen in non-devotees. And why is that? Sometimes this may sound like, oh, we're very self-righteous and puffed up, and we think we have all good qualities, and everyone else has all bad qualities, and no one else can have any good qualities. Well, obviously that's not true. We see some bad qualities in devotees, and we see good qualities in people who are not devotees. But these particular qualities that are being described are spiritual qualities. These are qualities of the soul, and therefore they are not going to fully manifest unless one is a devotee and is performing bhakti yoga, devotional service. And therefore, the full manifestation of good qualities will only manifest in devotees. And of course, there's a famous verse that confirms this, 5:18:12. Yayasti bhaktir bhagavati yakenshina sarva ganaistitra samsati sara harara bhaktyasya kato mahad guna manoritena sati devato bahi. All the demigods and their exalted qualities, such as religion, knowledge, and renunciation, become manifest in the body of one who has developed unalloyed devotion for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva. On the other hand, a person devoid of devotional service and engaged in materialistic activities has no good qualities. Even if he is adept at the practice of mystic yoga or the honest endeavor of maintaining his family and relatives, he must be driven by his own mental speculations and must engage in the service of the Lord's external energy. How can there be any good qualities in such a man? So, probably the question we should ask ourselves is, why do these qualities not always manifest? Or what prevents these good qualities being manifested in ourselves, particularly this quality of simplicity that we're talking about? This quality of simplicity is that simple faith. When one is not looking to gain materially, when one has no real interest other than the Lord, when one does not have material motivation, when one is very simple and very good-hearted and very open in their devotional service and their desire to serve Krishna and to please Krishna and obviously to please Guru and the devotees. So one of the answers is given in this verse of the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, this word, manoritena, interesting word, which means mental speculation. And it's combined with manoritena asati, which means mental speculation in the temporary material world. So in this material world, if our mind is always speculating, if our mind is not satisfied, this is the opposite. This is the opposite of this quality of simplicity, that we are not easily satisfied, that the mind is always going here and there. And we know that this is the business of the mind. This is our real difficulty. that our mind causes us so much difficulty. The Bhagavad Gita talks about the qualities of nishochiti nakangshati, hankering and lamenting. Again, this is what our mind is always doing, hankering and lamenting. That means that we are living in the past or the future, right? We are lamenting for the past. We are lamenting, you know, that we are, feeling that we should have, could have done this or should have done that, or this didn't happen to me. So it's always, you know, some lamentation for what could have happened or would have happened in the past, and that we are also then hankering for the future, making so many plans. I will do this and I'll do that, and maybe this will happen, and always looking at the future. So if we are in the past and we are in the future, it means we're not where? In the present. The present is actually the spiritual platform. There was a, this will only be appreciated by those over about 55 years old probably, but there was a very famous book during our hippie days called Be Here Now. Anybody remember that one? By Baba Ram Dass. Oh, I guess some of the younger people know it too. Okay, maybe it's still around. I don't know. I haven't heard much about it in the last 30 years. But anyway, very, very famous book everyone's into called Be Here Now. Oh, that's really heavy. You know, that's really profound. But actually, it is a profound idea. I don't think he had a clue what it really meant because he was a complete impersonalist. But the fact is that this idea of being in the present is a very profound spiritual idea, because that is the nature of the spiritual world. Everything is in the present in the spiritual world. In one purport of 2.9.10, Prabhupada says, in other words, everything in the transcendental world is everlasting, full of knowledge and bliss without deterioration. Since there is no deterioration, there is no past, present, and future in the estimation of time. It is clearly stated in this verse that the influence of time is conspicuous by its absence. I always love that phrase that Srila Prabhupada gave. You know, I think he uses it several times, that time is conspicuous by its absence. In other words, that's actually one of the characteristics of the spiritual world, that the influence of time is not there. Because what does the influence of time actually mean? In the material world, time is very prominent. Time means deterioration, right? Time means birth and death. Time means change from one material body to the other. That's the quality of time, what time does in this material world. Krishna says, obviously, in Bhagavad Gita, time I am, destroyer of the worlds. It's Krishna's quality and his energy of time which actually causes everything to end, everything to destroy, and ultimately it causes the birth and death of all living entities. So if there is no time, there's no birth and death. One is in the eternal position in the spiritual world. Now, it might be argued that, you know, there might be some sense of time in the spiritual world. Sometimes Krishna arranges some sense of time like, you know, it's morning and time to go and milk the cows. So, in other words, time may be there for the purpose of Krishna's pastimes, you know, to enhance what are we going to do today or something. So it's not like there's no sense of, it's not this impersonal idea like everything is kind of this one big energy or something and there's no... No, there's a certain variety and order of things that Krishna puts there so that the pastimes of Krishna's devotees are enhanced. But there's no deteriorating element of time as we see in this material world. So, therefore, if we are in spiritual consciousness, if we are actually Krishna conscious and remembering Krishna, we're not in the past, we're not in the future. That's the point. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't make plans. Of course we do. You know, we have to be realistic. We are in this material world, and time does pass in this material world. So we certainly have to make intelligent plans, strategies, etc. But that does not mean that that becomes our preoccupation. Our preoccupation is not with always thinking about what I will do tomorrow or what I should have done yesterday. You know, our consciousness needs to be more centered on my immediate conscious experience of Krishna consciousness, of the remembrance of Krishna and Krishna's service now. And that is actually what frees us from distress. That actually frees us from suffering and unhappiness, because most of our suffering is actually mental. Of course, there is bodily suffering. That's certainly there. But probably more often than not, our suffering is mental. It's our it's not so much the material circumstances, but it's our response to those circumstances, of how we understand those circumstances, how we react to them, and how we interpret them. That's what causes the living entity unhappiness. Anybody who works in the mental health field or has done counseling like that is very, very aware of this, that people whose otherwise their material circumstances of life may seem all right or even fairly good may experience great distress and great unhappiness due to the mind. And it almost doesn't matter what those circumstances are. A person can be very poor and be happy, a person can be rich and be happy, a person can be poor and unhappy, a person can be rich and unhappy. In other words, you know, there's not a one-to-one correlation to how much possessions that we have or what material things that I have that equate to happiness. And of course, most of us, I would say, had some profound realization of that at some point of our lives, and we became devotees. You know, so this is something that we all know and we all understand, but we also tend to forget, you know, because our minds are very, very active and they're always wandering from here and there, and because we're not completely purified, we sometimes forget this very simple part of our philosophy, and a certain amount of distress can still be there. But a devotee like Nabhaga was very satisfied in the present. That's the way he's called a Kenshin, or simple. You know, he doesn't have motivation. He's very simply satisfied by what comes. And that is only possible when it's in spiritual consciousness. You can't artificially do it. It's very, very difficult to say, all right, I don't care what happens, I'm satisfied. You may say that, but to actually experience it, you have to experience that on the spiritual platform. And when we don't experience that, that's a reminder to us to sort of recalibrate our consciousness. So when we're finding ourselves distressed and we're finding ourselves anxious, which I do about, you know, 5 or 6 times on the hour, per hour, you know, it's like, you know, when those experiences happen, which they constantly do, you know, that's when, you know, it's actually an opportunity for us to think, okay, why am I experiencing this stress? Why am I experiencing this anxiety? Because I'm probably thinking that somehow I'm the controller and I'm the doer and I have to fix this and I have to, you know, it's all I is preceding all of those mental statements. So we have to, that's when we have to, as I said, recalibrate our consciousness that, wait a minute, no, it's not I, it's Krishna. Krishna is in control. Srila Prabhupada is in control. My job is only, how am I serving them? How am I hearing and chanting the glories of Krishna? How am I serving my spiritual master? If I'm in that consciousness, then the result really is up to Krishna. And it's that idea of renouncing the results of our work, renouncing the results of our activities is very difficult. You know, that takes a real conscious effort, something that we have to strive for, and we have to keep reminding ourselves, and we remind each other in the association of devotees. You know, and that's why we have to continually be hearing the philosophy. If we're not hearing Krishna conscious philosophy, it's very, very easy to forget these simple messages and start thinking, I am the doer, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer, rather than Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, the supreme controller. He is the doer of all activity. So the result is that when we forget Krishna and we're thinking everything is up to us or everything, what happens? We become fairly anxious, stressed. We become unhappy. We become dissatisfied. Our material consciousness does not lead to a good result. It's not like we can say, okay, yeah, I forget Krishna, but I'm really happy when I'm not remembering Krishna, and it's really a wonderful experience. It's not. It's our experience of distress and suffering. You know, it's kind of like, so it's like you think, you know, we must be slow learners, right? I mean, if we do something continually over and over again which causes distress, why do we keep doing it? You know, I wish I could figure that out and give you the answer. But it's, it's our conditioning, you know, from so many lifetimes in this material world that it takes some time for us to recondition ourselves. You know, it's almost like we have to make our default mode automatically to be remembering Krishna. And that comes about through the process of sadhana. It's really what it is. There's really no simple answer. The association of devotees, the process of sadhana bhakti, the process of chanting Hare Krishna, fixes the mind on Krishna, and fixes the mind on Krishna's service, and takes the mind away from its material attachments and material preoccupations. And this happens right in the beginning. It's not that we have to become a very, very advanced devotee, you know, till the point that we will now start to experience this relief of suffering. Actually, the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu Nectar Devotion describes that there are six qualities of bhakti. They are relief of distress, it awards auspiciousness, one who has bhakti disregards liberation, it's very rare to attain bhakti, and it gives transcendental pleasure and attracts Krishna. Now, it's described by the Acharyas that of those six qualities, the first two are found, are experienced at the level of sadhana bhakti. The second two are at the level of bhava bhakti, and the third group of two are experienced fully at the stage of prema. Okay, so we're going to skip bhakti and prema for now, and you know, to go to my level, where we can understand in the process of sadhana that that first process or first result of devotional service, relief of distress, comes about. It's described that our immediate relief of distress, the ability to destroy suffering or klesha, is a quality or characteristic of the very beginning of sadhana bhakti. So that's pretty remarkable. In other words, right from the beginning, when we take up Krishna consciousness and we begin the practice of hearing and chanting under the guidance of the spiritual master, there is immediate relief from distress. And this is something I think that many of us experienced when we came to Krishna consciousness. You know, this great relief from that burden of the material world. That burden of not understanding what is our real identity, what is our real purpose, what is the meaning of life. Of course, those of you who were born in Krishna consciousness maybe didn't have to go through that. You knew from the very beginning what is the purpose of life. But for many of us, you know, this was a great source of suffering. And upon coming to Krishna consciousness, we're immediately relieved of those misconceptions. And we begin to experience the happiness of Krishna consciousness. It's not simply negative. It's not simply that one takes away the pain or relief. There's a positive. That positive is experiencing the pleasure of devotional service. And our relationship with Krishna, our relationship with Guru, our relationship with the devotees and the association of devotees is immediately there and experienced. So we can start to become relieved of that process of the suffering of the material world. We can give up the hankering and lamenting that is always there, become really fixed in that understanding that Krishna is my dearmost friend, that Krishna is the supreme controller, that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer of everything. And it's kind of like this great burden from the heart is relieved. It really is. You know, if I think I am the doer, that's a huge burden, isn't it? That means I'm responsible for everything. And, you know, usually, since we usually mess things up, you know, it's a very, very heavy burden. But as long as we maintain that, we're going to experience distress. And as soon as we can give that up, and simply give the fruits of the results of everything to Krishna, understand that everything is up to Krishna's mercy, and the devotee, this is one of the qualities of the devotee, that he relies upon the mercy and expects the mercy of Krishna. Not only do we hope for it, but we actually, the devotee, expects Krishna's mercy to be there. Now, we can't order up exactly how that mercy will manifest, what it's going to look like. You know, that mercy may be in the form of taking everything away from us. Or, it may, like Nabaga, everything was taken away and then he got everything back. Dhruva Maharaj wanted everything. He was willing, he gave it all up. And then Krishna gave it back to him. But it's not a deal. It's not like saying, okay, well, I'll say I'll give it all up and then I'll get it back. No, no. You have to sincerely be willing to give up everything. And then Krishna will give it to you if it's desirable for devotional service, or take it away if it's not. Because Krishna has a little different plan than we often do. We have so many material conceptions or ideas or strategies or things, but, you know, Krishna really only has one strategy for our life plan, and that's for us to advance in Krishna consciousness, to become purified and come back to him. That's all Krishna really cares about, you know, that we become devotees and that we come back to him, we go back to Godhead. So Krishna will arrange those things in our life, if we're sincere, to what is favorable for our devotional service and our returning to Him. And the more and more we can remember that and be in this consciousness, this simple consciousness that Nabhaga exemplified, of not being attached to our mental speculations, our possessions, etc., and simply surrender to the will of the Lord, then the result will be this relief from suffering and happiness, the real happiness of the living entity in our constitutional position as eternal servant of Krishna will manifest. Okay, we'll stop there. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. In case you knew, I wasn't observing Nirjala Ekadasi. Questions, comments? That's Madan Mahaprabhu. That's it. Go ahead, Madan.
So you were talking about how to see ourselves as not the doer and give up the results of activities. I think that takes a little practice. That's not such a... maybe we're gaining trust in Krishna and learning how to depend on Him. But I thought of this one verse actually from many years ago, and it actually seemed to fit right in there. It was in the fifth chapter, text 12. It says, "The steadily devoted soul obtains unadulterated peace, because he offers the results of all activities to me. Whereas," he always gives the opposite, "whereas a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, becomes entangled." And the purport, the last couple lines of the purport are just very poetic, where it says, "Therefore, activities in Krishna consciousness are on the absolute plane. They are transcendental and have no material effect. One is therefore filled with peace in Krishna consciousness. But," there it is, "one who is entangled in profit calculation for sense gratification," I thought that was poetic, "profit calculation for sense gratification, cannot have that peace. This is the secret of Krishna consciousness, realization that there is no existence besides Krishna is the platform of peace and fearlessness."
That was great. That was actually a better verse in purport than I had. Which one? What is it again?
5:12. Actually, the verses all around there.
Right in that same section.
Yeah.
Very nice.
The next verse. "When the embodied living being controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, he resides happily in the city of the nine gates, neither working nor causing work to be done." So he starts to give us something to think about here.
Yeah. Thank you. That's very nice. Mahatma, and then back to...
You quoted the Shasti Bhakti Bhagavata Kinchana verse.
Uh-huh.
So it appears from that verse that if we make the effort to advance in Krishna consciousness, we will develop good qualities as a byproduct, which then would cause some of us to think that independently making an effort to develop any good quality would be futile, because they can only develop as a byproduct of bhakti. So someone, for example, could recommend to me that I should be more humble, to which I could reply, "I'm just chanting Hare Krishna, and humility will come when it comes, when I become purified." So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. It often comes up in this type of discussion about development of these qualities. Does it come about just on its own, or should there be a separate endeavor towards it? Well, the verse clearly states, and some of these other purports, that those qualities, because they are qualities of the soul, that they will develop, they will manifest as one makes spiritual advancement. As one becomes more and more purified, the spiritual qualities will come out more and more. I don't think we should ever use that as an excuse to maintain bad qualities, or to not take the opportunity, because the other part to it is that, what did Krishna say? Oh, he said he is pleased only by elevated character and behavior. So in other words, if we're not manifesting these good qualities of character and behavior, Krishna's not pleased. You know, so, and what to speak of our God brothers and God sisters. We're also much more pleasing to our fellow devotees if we manifest these good qualities. So obviously we should attempt to, because it is pleasing to Krishna, knowing, of course, that it will take purification for them to fully manifest. You know, one devotee, a God brother of mine, said to me once, he said, you mentioned of humility. He said, I know that I'm not very humble by nature. He said, but I try to act humbly. He said, because if I act humbly, I might actually get the idea, and I might actually start developing it and appreciate that quality and start learning how to be. He said, and I'll also, it makes me a lot easier for my God brothers and God sisters for me to be around them. You know, so I kind of like that that answer that he described that. Certainly we want to develop these good qualities. They are signs of our advancement if we are making them, and we shouldn't maintain or hold on to bad qualities and thus please Krishna. I mean, but I think that the other part of it is we won't be able to fully manifest them independently of advancing in Krishna consciousness. It's an interesting question, and there's a lot of facets to it, I think.
Another facet, how do we deal with what appears to be a bad quality that we see in a devotee who is supposed to be, or we know who is very advanced? So we see apparent contradiction. Well, if he's advanced, why is he proud, or why is he angry, or why is he treating another devotee the way he's treating it?
Yeah.
So how do we... do we think, well, I'm just projecting and seeing my own fault, or is this actually part of the process that one can be very elevated and still be dealing with these anarthas? And
yeah, I think that's there, and I think we could all probably, if we wanted to go down that road, we could think of the examples of many of us who might have some good qualities and some bad qualities. And even if we have a certain level of advancement, all of those good qualities may not have manifested. And of course, Srila Prabhupada always gave the example that if a person's in the shower, you don't criticize them for being dirty. You know, of course, there's still some dirt there, but they are in the process of getting clean. And, you know, so if a person is actually in that process, in the shower, then we know that they will probably eventually be purified. And it may take some time, depending upon the person. You know, it's like, we know so many things happen, so many wonderful things happen through the process of bhakti, but there's no guarantee, it's not a timeline. It's not like in 1 year. I remember when probably some of you remember this, probably when we were new devotees, we thought it would be very quick. I mean, I remember people think, oh yeah, in 3 years I'll take sannyas, in 5 years I'll be a pure devotee or whatever, you know, like, you know, we were extremely unrealistic about the degree of our material contamination and anarthas and how easy the process would be. It is an easy process, but it may take some time due to our particular level of response. As far as how to deal, going more specifically to your question, how to deal with that particular devotee, I really think it has a lot to do with relationship. Because if you don't really have a relationship with a person, you're probably not going to be very successful pointing out the person's fault. Maybe actually the person has the quality of humility but has some of these other bad qualities, then they might hear you. But if they don't have the quality of humility, or if they're prideful, they probably are not going to hear well. I've usually found that people listen to you if they feel you're their well-wisher, if you're a friend or someone, you know, who they know that what you're saying is coming from a platform of, I wish you well. You know, I appreciate you, you're my friend, I care about you, and because I care about you, therefore, would you like to hear this? That's sometimes the way that I would put it. You know, would you like, in other words, are you willing to hear something that, you know, might be beneficial to you? They're not, because most people won't say, no, I don't want to hear that, you know. And I think if it's done in a very respectful mood of love, then, yeah, why not? But I generally feel, unless it's my position, because sometimes we're in a position of authority and we have to deal with devotees that way, it's kind of our service to do that. But if we're not, then I would say it really depends on having a relationship with the person. A couple other questions over here. Krishnam? I'll try to get everybody. I'm sorry, Tulsi, you were there too.
I was just wondering if you could touch real quick on the balance of not being the doers and not doing anything. Because I like sometimes it's actually easier to be like, well, it's up to Krishna, so therefore I'm not even going to try it. I'm not even going to do anything.
Yeah.
And so that's like the extreme of that, right. Not being the doer.
Yeah. Prabhupada said, act as though you are the doer, but no, you're not. You know, so no, Prabhupada didn't really go much for the lazy mentality. That was never part of our process in Krishna consciousness. You know, we want to work very hard and actively for Krishna. That's devotional service. But then we have to know that the results are up to Krishna. In fact, Krishna even says in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, you're entitled to your work, but not the result of the work. So in other words, we should do our work, our service for Krishna wholeheartedly, but know that ultimately, you know, the result may not be up to us. Right. Tulsi? Or Andrew? Go ahead.
On the point you were making of the qualities and good qualities, I'm recalling a class Bhaktivedanta Swami gave on pretending, which sort of had us all confused in the beginning. He gave it twice, and it's also in one of his warrior books. And what he was saying, I feel I'm getting it now, the qualities that we are portraying, it's not our natural qualities, because as you said, all those qualities are our spiritual qualities. So really, we're pretending to be, to have those qualities that aren't. Why don't we take or choose qualities that are spiritual qualities and begin in a desiring, wanting way to pretend that we have that quality and act in that way? And as you act, it then becomes in your life. Because I remember somebody questioned him about, what do you mean pretending? And you think it's false, but it's not false. If that's what you want, and you practice it, because we're practicing the other qualities, it's making us miserable.
That's a wonderful realization.
Yeah. Why not?
Because actually, we're pretending now. We're pretending that we're these bodies. We're pretending that I'm, you know, not a servant of Krishna,
right.
Or I'm pretending, and these bad qualities I'm exhibiting are really a pretense, and the reality are the spiritual qualities.
Right.
So that pretending really is not pretending. It's actually being who we really are.
That's right.
Thank you. That was very nice. I like that. Tulsi?
Thank you for the class. I was interested when you brought up the Ram Dass book, Be Here Now. I still have a copy. I bought it about 35 years ago. And interestingly, the book is named actually Remember Be Here Now. And I had a realization about that, because so many people, they like to beat you over the head sometimes with it, you know, if you're worried about something or if you're trying to plan something, say, oh, just be here now, you know, and it's almost like a weapon sometimes. But I had a realization about it a few weeks ago. As people sometimes do, you get up from one room to go to another room to get something else, and when you arrive in the other room, you forget what you were getting or what you went in there for. And another time, I got up to get something, and I was very conscious that I could forget. So I was like, okay, you were in the other room, you wanted X thing, now you're going into the other room to get X thing. And I was aware of there was a tension. It was like the first room was the past and the other room was the future. And I had to go between both of them and maintain both in mind, you know, because one started someplace and ended somewhere else. And I remember another time when my husband was sick, very sick, and I was trying to organize a home program, and I was freaking out, and he was at work, and I called him, and I said, I'm freaking out. How am I going to get this program ready? And he says, don't worry, don't be afraid, just surrender to Krishna. I was like, oh yeah, right. I said, what does surrender mean? And he said, surrender means doing the next thing. And I've held that my whole, you know, for years afterwards, you know, when I start to have a freak out, it's like, be here now could mean just do anything whimsical, you know, whatever you feel like. But doing the next thing for Krishna, it seems like you're always in that nice space of between the past and the future, and it's not that you neglect one or the other for whatever it is that you want in the moment. I don't know, it's just...
Yeah, thank you. That's good. And that's really the key, is that Krishna is the center. In other words, when we talk about the present, it's not just some arbitrary thing, but it means that we're with Krishna, thinking of Krishna. And therefore, as you said, then what is the next thing that I need to do for Krishna? You know, it's I mean, actually to think, what would Krishna want me to do right now? What would Prabhupada want me to do right now? That's a very, it's a very powerful and heavy thing, and it's difficult for us to do that all the time. You know, but it's a good check for us sometimes if we are feeling bewildered or stressed or freaking out, you know. What is it that Krishna wants me to do now, and what should I do next for Krishna? Yeah, thank you.
And he said that he said Lord Vishnu is in charge of the present, Brahma of the past, and Shiva the future. So if you go into the future, he'll say, "What are you doing here? Go back." And the only changes that we can actually make in our lives is in the present moment, which is Lord Vishnu is in charge of. Interesting.
Yeah, that is very interesting. Also equating it with, you know, being a Vaishnava is being in that present maintenance. That's the mode of goodness, also, right? Yeah. Hey. Oh, Pundarik? I'm sorry, Mathura.
Just about regarding humility, is artificial display of humility is a very prominent quality of sahajiyas. Mm-hmm. Actually, humility is following the instructions of the spiritual master. That is, and Rupa Goswami has given that. The instruction of Shruti Smriti Purana, the Pancharatra Vidyam Vinaya.